Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. Full interview archives there. Over 3,000 interviews now at scotthorton.org. And also, of course, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. And next up is Andrew Basevich. He's got a new one at Tom Dispatch. Of course, he's professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's the author of many books, including The New American Militarism and The Limits of Power. And the latest is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, which I haven't read yet, but that sure is a topic I'm interested in talking about. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Andrew?
Very fine. Thank you.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here. And what a great read today. I really like this essay. Bashing Isolationists While at War in the World. It's a really great piece. But if it's okay with you, I actually wanted to start out with something that Tom wrote in his introduction to your essay. As people familiar with Tom Engelhardt, TomDispatch.com, of course, he writes these introductory little essays to his guest essays. And in this one, he quotes from the New York Times. There's another one from DefenseNews.com that has an almost exact quote along the very same lines. And the quote is here, with the United States military out of Iraq and pulling out of Afghanistan, the Army is looking for new missions around the world. And basically, this is, it's just, we're going to invade Africa as a make-work program for the Army. Is that really the bottom line here?
Well, I mean, it's not a not quite an invasion, but I mean, this is sort of standard bureaucratic behavior, not just on the part of the military, but when you find your old mission going away, you need to gin up a new one in order to have some rationale for, you know, why you should continue to have a claim on the nation's resources. And after the failures and frustrations of Iraq and Afghanistan, it doesn't seem likely that we're going to be invading and occupying any countries anytime soon. And so the Army, my old service, finds itself trying to justify its existence. And so the latest idea, which I find troubling, to put it mildly, is not that we're going to invade African countries, but we're going to be sending missions to train or equip or advise or work with the indigenous forces in sub-Saharan African countries, supposedly because that will enhance their ability to resist terror. I fear that the effect will be to involve us in problems that we don't understand, can't handle, and that in effect our mucking around is going to probably lead to some larger military involvement down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sorry about that, because I was certainly using the phrase invasion loosely, if not lightly. It's only because I had in mind the piece by Nick Terse, also at Tom Dispatch, just 2 weeks ago, I think, about the military's humongous, or I forgot exactly his term, gigantic light footprint, that it almost amounts to an invasion of the entire continent when you look at how far and wide, and it is, again, small numbers and mostly at the invitation of the local governments, training forces, and these kinds of things. But it's just, wow, it is a gigantic new project here, much, maybe even more so than the Asia pivot is the Africa pivot here, no?
Oh, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, one of the things we should ask ourselves is, what are the interests that are at risk? I mean, there was a time, and I think for, frankly, understandable reasons, that the United States didn't fancy that it had all kinds of vital national security interests at stake in sub-Saharan Africa. But now suddenly, apparently, we do. And that's that finds expression in this greater willingness to send U.S. forces there. And I, you know, apart from the bureaucratic interests that are being served, it's difficult for me to see what are the strategic interests. And it ought to be strategic concerns that shape our military policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have an idea that maybe there are strategic concerns, just not good enough ones, namely keeping China out, that at some point if we ever have a conflict with China, we've got to be able to control every drop of oil on the planet so that they can't get it, that kind of thing. More than because that's what Houston wants, although maybe that's what Houston wants too.
Well, I think you can make an argument that we have an interest in keeping China out or maybe to, you know, minimizing the influence or limiting the influence they would wield. But the question is whether or not sending in U.S. forces is the way to do that. My understanding, and it's not a very deep understanding, is that China's growing influence in places like Africa stems from the fact that they offer things that Africans want, that they have programs to build infrastructure, that they are making investments in the exploitation of African natural resources, particularly mineral resources. So if you want to counter Chinese influence, then it seems to me you need to play the Chinese game and do a better job of playing it than they are. And again, sending in a bunch of missions of U.S. forces seems to me to be not particularly relevant to that issue.
Hmm. Well, I guess you're just an isolationist or something if you don't want to control everything in the world. You know, when I read your essay this morning, I was reminded of a thing I read. Yours is, you're just picking on the New York Times here, and boy, you just pick a hole right through them. But I always remember one from Newsweek from, say, 1998 or 99 or something, and they actually had a picture of the dark, shadowed corner of a dingy room. And then the headline was, "Will the American people retreat and cower into the shadows of isolationism? Or will we face the brave new 21st century, tall and proud?" And I mean, it was really like that. You're just weak, and you're just afraid, and you just don't want to lead. And so get the hell out of the way if you don't want to take over the whole planet, Professor Bacevich. Come on.
Well, and I mean, that argument, which is made repeatedly, is one that is intended to discipline the American people, I think, to suppress any serious debate or consideration of alternatives, and therefore to perpetuate this notion that we have to exercise global leadership primarily by relying on our on the military instrument. And it's a shame that it works so well. And it's really a travesty that so many institutions like the New York Times engage in this kind of practice.
Well, you know what's kind of funny about it to me is how hollow it rings, especially now. And I guess it is still very effective, you know, on some. But, you know, if you stop and think about it for a minute, come on, nobody accuses Brazil of being isolationists because they're not out invading and toppling and regime changing and leading everything. They're minding their own business. They're doing what a normal nation would. But for any American to want that, I mean, well, I'll put it this way. I would say there are actual isolationists in this country, the very crankiest guys in the comment section at the American Conservative magazine, but I wouldn't even say the writers there. I mean, even the paleocons, they're very anti-war, but they're not even really isolationists, even favoring trade restrictions. Well, that doesn't really make them isolationists. There are
You're right. I think you're right, but I think you put your finger on the key issue that a normal nation doesn't necessarily have to be, doesn't have to strike the posture that we habitually do. But remember, in the eyes of many, many Americans, to include people who congregate in and around Washington, we're not a normal nation. We're different and we're special. And in order to demonstrate that specialness or to fulfill our special mission, the argument is made. That's why we have to established this kind of global posture. If we were able to simply acknowledge that we are one nation among many, the nation we happen to love, but we are one among many, then it would become easier, I think, for us to evaluate things from a pragmatic point of view. You know, where do we need to be, and where do we not need to be? You know, where do we need to exercise our power, and where are we foolish to try to employ our power? And to make decisions based on pragmatic considerations rather than what are, in essence, vast ideological, imagined ideological claims, which seem to, you know, be impossible to eliminate, even when our vast claims, for example, in the wake of 9/11, end up creating such catastrophes for ourselves and for others.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I picked up on one thing here. I could be off, but it was something I thought of when I was reading your essay. Was that, I mean, you really focus on how they always call it, oh, and you go back for decades here, the isolationists. Oh, you're all a bunch of pro-Hitlerites or cowards or whatever you are. But it's always the new isolationism. And it occurred to me that, in a sense, what they're doing there is they're trying to deny any continuity, that this is really, there is a peaceful tradition in America. It's just we never win the peaceniks. We never get our way. But there's always been a strain of Americans, not all just hippies and not all pro-Hitlerites, who don't want to intervene all around the world. But by calling it the new isolationism, whenever they do, they sort of just skip all of any continuity and tradition and go straight back to the worst thing that Charles Lindbergh ever said into an open
right.
mic, right?
I think you put your finger on it. Exactly right. Yeah.
It's funny about that, how it really, well, I'm a George Carlinian at heart when it comes to all this stuff, and the manipulation of language is just so powerful, the way an entire massive kind of subtle screw job, you know, brainwashing,
well,
of people, manipulation, you know,
maybe,
yeah.
Brainwashing's a little
strong,
too,
yeah.
Harsh, but it
yeah.
gets to the point that, you know, there are certain terms which are privileged, even if there's no real empirical justification for them, and there are other terms that simply are not allowed in discourse, and I'm not one of these guys who think there's some kind of a big conspiracy in the mainstream media. But these most authoritative organs of opinion, like the New York Times, perpetuate these false notions, mm-hmm. and thereby, I think, make it very difficult for us to evaluate realistically what our policy achieves, what it doesn't achieve, what it costs, and what might be some alternative approaches.
Right. And by the way, I didn't mean to make it sound like I accept their premise that the America First movement before World War II were a bunch of pro-Hitlerites. Just that's what they say. Obviously,
yes.
John T. Flynn was no Nazi. Come on.
Right.
Those were American patriots there. I just, but I realized that it sounded for a minute like I was accepting their premise.
No.
Argument. All right. Anyway, listen, I know you've got to go, but I really appreciate you coming back on the show, and I'm going to try to make it a point to read your book, because I certainly agree, without even getting into it, that this whole foreign policy amounts to a betrayal of the soldiers that are sent out there to do it, most of whom are believe that they're doing the right thing for God and country and all that kind of stuff. And so I want to get it and read it and interview you about it. I hope
Good.
I can soon.
Thank
you very
much,
Andrew.
Okay, I enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. All right, everybody, that is Andrew Bacevich, again, professor at Boston University. And you got to read this thing. It's really funny history here. Bashing isolationists while at war. Every time America is bombing somebody, somebody in the New York Times is writing how America is just backing down from the world and whatever's going to happen without our leadership. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here for myheroesthink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from myheroesthink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com.